Herzlich willkommen zurück bei Agency Live Deutschland.
Und damit auch zu einer ganz speziellen Folge. Wir verlassen heute unser Münchner Studio und geben ab zu unseren belgischen Kollegen und Kolleginnen Luis und Robin. Die beiden hatten einen ganz besonderen Gast bei sich, beziehungsweise über eine Fernschaltung, Michael Farmer, eine echte Agentur-Koryphäe, der Agenturen und deren Umwelt die letzten 20 Jahre begleitet hat, analysiert hat und super spannende Learnings und Insights aus dieser Erfahrung teilt. Die beiden interviewen ihn in insgesamt 2 Folgen und wir nehmen das Ganze auch in unseren Agency Live Deutschland Podcast mit rein, weil wir der festen Überzeugung sind, dass auch hier spannende Erkenntnisse und Learnings für euch vorhanden sind. Kleine Vorwarnung, der Podcast findet in Englisch statt. Wir hoffen aber trotzdem, dass ihr alles gut verstehen könnt und von vorne bis hinten mit dran bleibt.
Damit starten wir rein in diese Folge. Viel Spaß! Bevor wir mit der heutigen Folge starten, möchten wir euch zunächst erklären, worum es uns und unserem Partner Teamleader in diesem Podcast überhaupt geht. Wir laden in jeder Folge spannende Persönlichkeiten aus der deutschen Agenturszene ein, die mit ihren Erfahrungen und ihrem Wissen andere Agenturen inspirieren und motivieren möchten.
Und genau dort setzt Teamleader mit seiner leistungsstarken Agentursoftware an. Diese hilft bereits über 4000 Agenturen dabei, Terminfristen einzuhalten, Budgets zu kontrollieren, Gewinnmargen zu steigern, Kapazitäten zu planen und vieles mehr, damit ihr euch voll und ganz auf eure Kreativität konzentrieren könnt. Von Agenturen für Agenturen. Und los geht's mit unserer heutigen Folge.
Good evening, Europe. Welcome to Agency Life, the must-follow podcast if you want to run a better agency. I'm Robin from Teamleader, here in the studio with my ever-so-cheerful sidekick, Luise. Hello, Luise.
Good evening, Europe, indeed, and good evening, Robin. As you heard it right, for the first time this episode, we're switching to English.
Indeed, the language of Shakespeare. But why?
Well, I hope our loyal listeners aren't too confused, but they don't have to worry. We're still just Robin and Luise. We're still just bringing you the conversations with the finest agency people in the business. But Robin, do tell, why aren't we speaking Dutch this time?
Yes, so usually, Luise, as you know, you and I have conversations with agencies from Belgium and the Netherlands, and then we have some other colleagues who do it with agencies from France and Germany. But today, we're going all the way across the Atlantic. We have an American guest in the studio.
It's all very exciting. Well, come to think of it, your good evening Europe in the beginning, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense to our guests. I think he's not in Europe. He probably just ate lunch. I don't think it's evening over there at all, so it might be all a little bit confusing to him.
Yeah, you know what? Let's just ask him directly. Hello, Michael. What was for lunch?
Robin, hello. I'm still waiting for lunch, so I'm going to have a late lunch today. I'm delighted to be with you, and I don't feel like I'm a stranger to Europe, even though I'm more than 3,000 miles away right now in the States. I lived in Europe for more than 20 years in Switzerland, Germany, France, the UK, and Turkey, and did some wonderful work there, I think, with my great clients. So I'm very happy to be with you and talking as if I'm sitting right across from you in Belgium.
Yeah, thanks to the wondrous ways of the internet, this is all made possible. Very cool. So thank you, Michael, and I hope we will not make you wait for your lunch too long. Before we really get started, Michael, in the final version, our Dutch-speaking audience will hear a fan of yours, Peter, speak very rivetingly about why he thinks you're such an interesting person for us to talk to. But for the uninitiated, could you quickly introduce yourself to our audience?
Surely. Happy to do so. I am American, born in the Midwest many years ago. And I went to business school and got an MBA after serving in the U.S. Navy for 5 years and began a consulting career, first with the Boston Consulting Group and later with Bain & Company. And it was with Bain that I ran the new Munich, Paris, and London offices in the 80s when we were a new consulting firm. I left because I loved consulting and I wanted to do more of it myself. So I stayed in London, started Farmer and Company in 1990. And then, as it turned out, within 2 years, I had my first ad agency client. It was Ogilvy in London that at the time was having some profitability issues right after they were bought by WPP. And we worked with them for some time. It was quite successful. We did improve their profitability with their fine leadership. And that convinced me that the agency business, which was just starting to go through so many strategic changes in the 90s, was an industry that I wanted to devote myself to. So I spent another 10 years or so in Europe working with Ogilvy and Gray and Shell and what was then Thompson before moving back to the States in 2001 and continuing my practice. In 2015, I had just about, 20 years of work behind me and or more in the industry. And I thought it would be a good time to summarize what I knew. So I wrote a book called Madison Avenue Manslaughter, based on what I had learned working with a number of agencies around Europe and the States. And then since then, I have written a second book called Madison Avenue Makeover, which is about the transformation of Huge, a digital creative agency based in Brooklyn, but with a global footprint, which had a new CEO who decided that he was going to change everything. He didn't want to be part of Madison Avenue's manslaughter. He wanted to do something different. That's the summary, but it's an industry I'm passionate about and frustrated with because there's so much more it could do, so much better it could be, and there are a lot of things that get in the way of that. So it makes for a very interesting consulting practice, and I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, Michael, it's clear that you're the perfect person for this this podcast, for this conversation. You have an impressive track record as a management consultant, but also at the agency side. So we're very interested to hear your perspective on the industry. It's an industry you've repeatedly called broken. We're like, oh, is the industry broken? So can you explain to our listeners, what is the main problem in the agency industry today?
Sure. I can best explain that, Louise, by saying, first of all, I did not understand anything about the agency world when I did my first work some 30 years ago. And that was often the case in a consulting assignment. You know, when you walk into an industry, whether it's an advertising industry or a chemical industry or glass making, automotive, you don't know what's going on. And it isn't always a great direction for the senior people to tell you, this is the problem we have, and this is the work that we need done. I found that it helps to develop a personal and data-driven point of view about what's happening. And I came to the conclusion that the industry was broken after several years of discovering that ad agencies do not document or measure the amount of work they do with clients. And as a result of that, they do not use it to negotiate fees. And in fact, they don't even really know how much work they're doing for any given client. And that is a very odd thing, because at the most simple, ad agencies are very creative factories that make ads for clients. They make strategies and they make ads. So they are doing things, and they are doing deliverables for their clients. And yet they don't use that those metrics to determine how much they get paid. So in a way, they are agreeing to accept a certain amount of money and to allocate people for an uncertain amount of work. And at the same time, most of the big agencies are owned by someone who need increasing profits from them. So if you have an uncertain amount of work, which as it turns out is growing, and fees that are being held down a bit by clients, you're really creating a recipe for disasters, because often the only way agencies can make a profit margin is to downsize. And there can't be anything worse than getting rid of people when the workload is growing and the strategic complexities are even more complex. So I said, this is a broken industry because the agencies are certainly not protecting themselves and they're not protecting their talent. And they're not even making sure that they do great work for their clients to drive improvements in sales. Because if you do more and more work with fewer and fewer people, there's going to be an effect on quality. Mm-hmm. All of that adds up to all the different ways that I think the industry is broken. And yet it is not a permanent break. You know, it's there are things that can be done about it. But I don't see the leadership either in the marketing departments of clients or those people that are running agencies coming to grips with the broken nature of the industry. That's what really frustrates me about where things are headed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you think that agencies are not aware of these problems, of the fact that they're working more for less money?
I think that agencies don't think about the quantity of work they're doing. I think at this point, they are so insecure about their relationships that they are terrified they're going to get fired every 3 years, which, by the way, has been... That's been pretty much the case for the last 20 years. So even when agencies are made aware of the problem, which I always do when I consult, one of the things I do is come in and analyze their scopes of work and show them how much work they're doing for each client and show them how little they're being paid for that work and how they are understaffing that work because they can't afford it. I show them all that. And it doesn't necessarily change their behavior because they still think, although they don't say it, but they still think, I'm more afraid of being fired than I am of doing the wrong thing as far as running my agency. In fact, they don't want to confront their client and say, look at all the work we're doing and look at how little the fee is. And we have some analysis now that shows, you know, that Farmer did that shows that there's a big gap. They're afraid to do that. They don't want to confront their clients. They want to be nice people and go along and keep them happy and service them and retain them for next year. But I think they're playing a loser's game. You know, I don't think they're playing a game they can win by doing that.
So basically what I hear from you is that these agencies are basically staying in somewhat unhealthy relationships with their clients rather than address the problem at hand, which is they're being underpaid for a lot of work.
Yes, I don't think they would agree that the relationships are unhealthy because they are working to make them feel good.
Mm.
But what I'd say is something can feel good and be bad. And I think that that's really where we are in these relationships. They feel good. Everyone worries about the surveys that are done about client satisfaction, et cetera. They worry about, you know, all of those things. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at how much money is spent on agencies, how much money is spent on media, and you look at how much work is being done in the scope of work, and then you look at the results that are achieved by this, and you'd have to say that's unhealthy.
I want to dig deeper into the scopes of work. You've mentioned it a couple of times by now. Scopes of work is a way to kind of analyze or measure the amount of work that's being done in agencies. Yes. Can you explain briefly what the concept of scopes of work?
Sure.
Entails?
And let me highlight what it was when I started my first assignment with Ogilvy London in 1992. They at the time had 20 clients or so. They had 50 creatives that were divided into 25 teams of a copywriter and a copywriter and an art director. And they were doing about 380 ads during the year. And they were all TV ads, print ads, or radio ads. And it was all original work. So 50 creatives were doing about 7 deliverables a year. TV, radio, print, original work. The work received a lot of attention from the executive creative directors. They looked at every single piece that went out the agency. And they, you know, throughout the process of developing a TV ad or a print ad or a radio script, they were reviewing the work of the creative teams. And as far as they were concerned, it had to be done right before it would go to the client. Anyway, that's the way the business used to be. It is the way the industry mythologizes itself. Like, we do the work, the work, the work. We make sure the work is right before it goes to the client. Our senior executive creators who make millions of euros per year bring their creative attention to the work of more junior people and they get it right. That's the myth. Okay. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, I did another study for another Ogilvy office in the world. So this is now, we're in 2023. This is in 2021. And that office, which is in a big city, also had 50 creatives, just like Ogilvy back in the old days. Ogilvy, the old days, had 380 pieces of work. Do you know how many pieces of work were being done by 50 creatives in 2021? 15,000. 15,000. Wow. Of which 13,000 were adaptations of 2,000 pieces of original work. The average creative was doing 300 pieces per year. What are they? Facebook posts, Instagram posts, online video, direct marketing, banner ads, email marketing. Do you think anyone ever looks at the work that a creative is doing if they're doing one a day? No. In other words, the creative directors are now looking at the very small part of the scope of work. Scope of work to me is the sum of all the work that the agency's doing. So the executive creative directors might still be looking at the TV work. They might still be looking at the sophisticated print work. But believe me, apart from maybe being involved in looking at the strategy for digital and social, they're not looking at the executions. They can't possibly. And the agency really has turned into a factory for grinding out thousands and thousands of pieces every month. It's a very different business. I can't think of another industry in my long consulting career that has gone through as many changes and at the same time is as ignorant about how dramatic those changes have been and how it needs a rethink today. And what's the rethink? Well, if clients aren't growing today, they need to grow in the future.
Yeah.
That's the only way they can maintain their share price, continue to attract talent, and be relevant in the marketplace. It's all about growth and competition. So if agencies aren't doing that, they need to do it. Clients need to come up with better scopes of work that actually work. And I believe that the 15-year investment in digital and social, as exciting as it has been, hasn't delivered the results. I mean, does anyone dare say that maybe digital and social aren't as good as people have always thought they would be, even with better targeting? I think it's worth asking that question.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you all say. But we'd like to hear about the impact of your approach, your scope of work approach to pricing and putting a value on your work, because that's an interesting part of your books.
Okay, well, that is the fun part. And it was really fun as a consultant to figure out how could you measure a scope of work and what would you use as the metric? You can't say we're doing 25 kilos of work. You can't weigh it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that it was the way you would measure a scope of work is the way you would measure calories with fruit. You know, what is a bowl of fruit? If you have bananas and apples and peaches and grapes and pears, You could say, how many calories are in this bowl of fruit? You could do that. There's a way of doing it. And because the departments of agriculture of the countries in Europe and in the United States have developed tables that says a banana has X number of calories per 100 gram. An apple has so many calories per 100 grams. That sort of thing exists. So all you'd have to do is take that table, measure the weight of the fruit, and you could calculate how many calories in each piece of fruit and add them up. And that is the approach that I took with the scope of work. We'll go back to 1992. I was with Ogilvy. We finally figured out that they were doing 380 pieces of work. But then we had to ask, well, you're doing TV, radio, and print. How, I had to ask the creatives, how are those different for you? Well, they'd say, well, TV takes more time. Takes more time than print, and that takes more time than radio. Radio is just a script, so that's done by a copywriter. You don't have an art director involved. When you have a print ad, you have both pictures, photography, picture, color, action, words, and have a video production like a TV thing or a film production at the time. You know, you've got moving pictures, you've got actors, you've got scenes, and you've got and all that other stuff. So we started from the idea that weight would be relative to how much creative effort was involved. And they were quick to say us that not all TVs are the same or not all prints are the same. There are two basic types. There's an original piece of work, and there's an adaptation. So an adaptation is you had an existing piece of work and you changed it somehow. You changed the language or you made it shorter. So we learned, okay, for each deliverable, TV, radio, print, there's an origination and an adaptation, and they have a different weight in terms of creative time. And then in addition, they told us that they're not all the same. There are really difficult ones, there are typical ones, and there are really simple ones. So we thought, okay, we'll call it creative complexity, low, average, and high. So we focused on the creative workload, and we developed a unit of work. We invented a calorie, so to speak, called the scope metric unit, an SMU. And an SMU is really the size of a deliverable in terms of its creative effort. Now, it varies by media type, it varies by origination versus adaptation, and it varies by creative complexity.
So you've mentioned, Michael, that at Huge, they kind of took the productization route. They decide which products they offer, and they ask a fixed fee for that. So I think that is one way to go about it. Does managing your agency based on scopes of work necessarily mean that you have to price your work at a product-based fee, or can you also explore other options like value-based pricing, performance-based pricing? How do these business models relate to the scopes of work?
Personally, I am not in favor of value-based pricing, meaning the work delivers a high value, the clients are growing, they're making more money, we get a big bonus. First of all, that does not exist in 99% of the industry at all. It's a myth. And it kind of bothers me that so many agencies say, we should be paid on a value basis. That's what's wrong with the industry. The industry does not recognize the value we're delivering, and they're paying us on man hours. And that's wrong. We should be paid on a value basis. Well, the truth of the matter is, I don't think the work's generating value. Prove it to me that you're generating value. Clients, 21 out of the top 50 advertisers have not grown very much in the last 13 years. So stop dreaming about this fantasy. Clients don't think your work is delivering value. That's why they change every 3 years. Now, look, what's better, Louise, is get paid fairly for the work you do. If that work delivers value, get a higher price for that work next year. That is what the consulting firms have been doing for 40 years. And today, Bain, McKinsey, Boston Consulting, A.T. Kearney, Booz Allen, Accenture, Deloitte, PwC, IBM, all of these consulting firms, they pay their, or they charge their people out at 5 times their salary or 6 times their salary because the work delivers value. Mm-hmm. Agencies are lucky to get 2 times multiple on the cost of their people, and their people are cheaper. So I think the secret to pricing is price for the work. That is a fair, you know, like we're doing 10 things for you. Here are the price of the 10 things. You're buying 10 products from us. And here's the price of the 10. And by the way, clients I have use scope metrics as the basis for a price. We mm-hmm. charge a price per SMU for the work. Mm-hmm. I'm implementing that system at a major pharmaceutical company today. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but it makes sense. Pay for the work, not for a guesstimate of man hours. Mm-hmm. And then if the work generates value, pay more for it in coming years because it's worth more. Louise, there's another reason for product pricing as opposed to man hour pricing, which is that artificial intelligence is coming in and will take away at least 20% of the man hours that are being used by agencies. And that could lead to 20% loss of income overnight. Now, think about the Ogilvy agency that I mentioned that was doing 15,000 pieces of work, of which 13,000 were adaptations. And particularly ad banners and email marketing and Facebook posts and that sort of thing. Believe me, software, artificial intelligence software can replace almost all of that work. Now, 13,000 adaptations versus 2,000 originations doesn't mean that it's more than 40% of the total workload. The 13,000 adaptations are about 40% of the workload in that situation. And if AI only took half of it, that would still be 20%.
Okay.
So even before AI came in, I felt that agencies should move to productization, get paid for your work. But with the advent of AI, I now think that it is, your house is on fire. You better do something about it right now.
Okay.
This is going to happen very quickly.
So in your opinion, AI may be like the final thing that kills off the billable hour as the basis for pricing and for agencies to run.
I think so. And I think many agencies will learn the hard way. I've been invited to sit with agency task forces that were looking at AI. And they were asking questions like, how do we make money from AI? It, almost like, oh, here's a new and shiny thing. There must be a way we can make money with it. And the advice that I've given to them is stop thinking about that. Start thinking about what is the degree to which AI could destroy our business in the next couple of years? And then let's develop a strategy to keep that from happening. Because I think that if we waste our time thinking about how to make money, it's going to come in the door and destroy our economics. So, Louise, I am very excited about AI coming in because it's creating a greater urgency about understanding the scopes of work. and understanding the nature of agency economics. So it's like AI is like an ally for me now, because I can talk to agencies about the urgency of thinking about productization and pricing their services very, very differently to protect themselves. So I'm excited about it, but I think that it's going to be tough in the next couple of years. I'm sure of it. Agencies will not dominate AI. Their clients will use it, and they will replace agency work with AI stuff.
Wow.
On that relationship with between agencies and advertisers, we already used the word unhealthy. You also used the word vendor. So how would you assess the relationship between these agencies and the advertisers in the industry in 2023?
Okay, well, I think it has deteriorated. The relationships have deteriorated when digital and social came in. And then, Robin, I'll come up to 2023. But if you remember in the old days, an agency like BBDO or TBWA or Ogilvy or JWT or Leo Burnett would work a very long time with a client, and they would do TV, radio, print. They would do that. When digital and social came in around 2007, the agencies were not diversified. They could not do all that stuff. So their clients had to go out shopping. And they then said, well, we'll keep Leo Burnett, but we're going to add a social agency, a search agency, a digital agency, maybe a programmatic agency. And they started dividing up the agency franchise, and they dropped the idea of an AOR, an agency of record. So all of a sudden, and it didn't happen overnight, but gradually a single agency became a portfolio of agencies. And when that happened, the client said, we have to be in charge now. We have to decide which of these agencies get how much money and what work they do. If we listen to them, they're all going to be fighting with each other for every dollar or euro of work. They're going to be fighting for fees and fighting for work. They can't be trusted. So we have to be in charge. And then in addition, procurement said, yes, and I want to look at fees because I don't want to overpay for, if we're going to work with 10 agencies, I don't want to overpay for that. So the net effect of 15 years of that is that now clients are in charge. Clients decide scopes of work. Clients decide the fees. Client decides which agencies they keep and which ones they change every year. And the agencies are now order takers and order executors. They're just service providers. They're afraid of fighting back. They're afraid of disagreeing. They know they're in competition for a limited pool of money. They have a lot of people at the client to keep happy. And now agencies are passive, nervous, and overworked. That's what I think has happened. And that's why it's even harder to bring about change. Mm-hmm. Because let's just go to the scope of work issue. If a client gives you a scope of work that has 4,000 deliverables in it, or if the total scope of work has 4,000 deliverables, and history has proven that it doesn't deliver growth, the agencies should say, I don't think that's the best scope of work for what we need. We have our own view. This is the work that we think should be going on. And that's challenging the marketing people that are putting it together. I'm working in some situations where we are encouraging the agencies to create that type of conflict, to say, we've got a 13-year record that the scopes aren't delivering value. We are going to come up with our own view, and we're encouraging them to do it. It makes them very nervous because it's been years and years since they were in that position. And most of the people in the agency today have never had the experience of being a genuine partner. They've had the experience of being a servant. Mm-hmm. They've had the experience of servicing the client and doing what the client wants and trying to keep them happy. And so they even lack the disciplines that are involved in being the type of partner that challenges, you know, the assumptions in a nice way and provides the analysis that allows the client to see that maybe the agency's got a right idea. So anyway, 2023, Robin, I think agencies are service providers, nervous, overworked, and by the way, under pressure from their holding companies to deliver more money and more profit. That is another dimension that makes their lives complicated.
So earlier on in this conversation, you were talking about having difficult conversations and being like the bringer of bad news and how people don't really like hearing that. Are we at the breaking point where in order to make an omelet, we're going to have to break some eggs for the industry to thrive in the future?
Yes. You have to break the eggs to make the omelet. And really, it's the culture of the agency that needs changing so that the operational practices can change. And what do I mean by the culture? This is an industry that has had one mantra for 60 years, which is we're creative. Creativity delivers value. We're always striving to be more creative. It is not simple to be creative. If we are failing at our episode, mission, it's because our creativity is lacking. And that we need to constantly upgrade the quality of the creative department in order to be more creative. And if you think about what we've been talking about here, you know, for the last hour or so, the truth of the matter is maybe it is creativity it's lacking, but there are some fundamental business practices that are lacking too, like, we don't know what work we're doing. We have not evaluated whether the work we're doing delivers value for the client. The truth of the matter is our clients are not growing, even though we talk about giving them all the creativity that we're capable of. And I'd say that the culture of the agency needs to recognize that being creative is important, but it must be within a healthy environment. If you make an omelet, you can't put the eggs in a pan that is too hot or it will burn. Or if you put it in a pan that's too cold, it will never develop a crust and the eggs won't cook. In other words, you have to do some practical things so that creativity can work. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought about one particular company, Burger King, which is, you know, a distant competitor to McDonald's, but has won more creative awards over a decade than any other known company. And yet, if you look at its own performance in terms of sales per store, sales per restaurant, it's one of the worst performers in the industry. So Burger King is lauded as their creative geniuses, and they sell less than half the dollars per store or euros per store anywhere in the world. Why? Well, maybe their outlets aren't clean, or maybe the product isn't very good, or maybe the people are rude, or maybe the locations aren't very good. There are a lot of reasons, but doing really creative ads for Burger King doesn't help them operationally. And yet the industry talks about what geniuses they are. They're not geniuses. They are underperforming in their marketplace. They're mm-hmm. failing their own employees and their management, and yet they win awards. So I think that the culture of creativity needs to be challenged in a positive way, meaning, yes, we always need more creativity, but there are other things that we have ignored that we are not doing, and they have to be just as important in our environment. Technology is one of them, and good sound management practices are a third. They have to work as a team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is, agencies are still looking back to Bill Birnbach, 1959, mm-hmm. to David Ogilvy, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, to Leo Burnett, to all these great people that did astonishing work 60 years ago. But it was a completely different world. It was a world that was recovering from the Second World War. It was a world that where television was new and television advertising was new. It was a world where consumers didn't have many of the things they needed. They didn't have cars. They didn't take holidays. They didn't make financial investments. And so, and they didn't have, you know, they hadn't purchased all the household appliances that they would purchase. It was a growing economy from 1945 to 1990 everywhere in the West and in Asia and Latin America and the States. And television helped to fuel that with creative work. That's not where we are today at all. Mm-hmm. You know, the average household is well served with cars and appliances and vacations and education and many other things. Selling stuff to the market is harder. And just pure creativity doesn't do it. It doesn't matter. You've got to do so many things. You got to do what Amazon does so well. You know, total reliability, great mm-hmm. customer base, overnight delivery, easy returns. You know, they make it so easy. And so it's a different challenge. And I think the first thing to bring about change is they have to look at their what they've been saying about themselves and ask whether it really is enough. So there's a need for a cultural change, and then put together the business practices that will make that work. Yeah. Robin, does that sort of answer your question on that?
In Technicolor, yeah, perfectly. Oh, thank you very much, Michael.
Well, one thing I read that I thought was really interesting in story of Huge is I think the new CEO said we need to transform agencies into growth acceleration companies. And we need to abandon the agency label. How do you feel about that?
Well, he felt that as long as they told the marketplace that they were an agency, even if they said, Huge is an agency, but we're different. He felt that as soon as he used the word agency, his potential clients would put him in the same container as every other agencies they've ever worked with. So he wanted to get rid of the agency label. He did not impose this on his management team. In fact, I remember at the first retreat that Huge had when they were debating what kind of a company should we be. I remember one of the executives said, maybe we should stop calling ourselves an agency. And that happened when they had decided they were going to be a growth acceleration company for their clients. And he said, I don't see how we can use the term agency because agencies are something else. Agencies are organizations that try to bring creativity to work. But that work doesn't have a purpose. So if the purpose is our mission, we can't use the word agency. We have to come up with something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think then, Robin, we should maybe call our podcast Growth Acceleration Company Life.
Yeah,
it's that agency life.
The graphic designers are going to have a hard time with all those letters, but we'll just have to make
it. Yeah, you'll need a new website and everything. That would be something.
That'll it'll add like 8,000 SMUs.
Yeah.
To next week.
Oh yeah, exactly. I'm
dreading it already. Yeah. You've been very, very clear and interesting in this podcast, Michael. Allow me to try to summarize, and then you can think, see if I got it right. So three things need to change in the industry. One, agencies need to change their mission, help brands perform better. Secondly, agencies need to be partners, giving an independent point of view instead of seeing themselves as vendors. And then thirdly, agencies need to be paid for the amount of work that they do based on SOWs. Did I get that right?
You got that 100% right, Robin. And I think that if you were thinking about wanting to transform an agency as a CEO, you would say, I know that I need a new mission. I know that I need to develop the conditions for partnership with my clients. And I know that I need to be paid for product, not man hours. So by what type of change program can I bring that about? And I think that those three things will lead to other subjects that need to be addressed later on. But I think from a headline standpoint, you picked the three highest priorities: mission, partnership, productization.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Michael. A lot of food for thought for our listeners. Also, some talk about food, hashtag making omelets. But I can imagine, dear listener, that you also have some questions. You may recognize the issues that Michael describes, but what can you do to change things? How do you transform your agency business model?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing, Robin, that we have another episode coming. Because next time, Michael will go a little bit deeper into the ways to get started in your own agency. How do you start working with scopes of work? What's the impact on your pricing? How do you start the discussion with your clients? All of that, we'll go into that in our next episode.
Yeah. So for now, Michael, thanks for sharing your ideas with us. And to our listeners, please tune in to hear Michael again in 2 weeks. And until then, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform or sign up for our bi-weekly email update at agencylive.nl and.be. Or if you really like French and German, agencylive.fr and agency-life.de.
That is also where you'll find all previous Agency Life podcasts. We have topics like mergers and acquisitions, offshoring talent, scaling your agency, and so much more.
All great
Robin
stuff.
And Louise, thank you so much for having me on this episode. It's been a real delight to talk to you. And happy to come back anytime to continue our discussions.
Yeah, the pleasure was all ours, and we'll hear from you soon. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
See you.
Das war die erste Folge aus dem Interview mit Michael Farmer. Es wird noch eine zweite Folge folgen, aber danach switchen wir grundsätzlich wieder in den deutschen Bereich. Solltet ihr aber Erfahrungen und auch Podcasts aus dem Ausland, aus dem Agenturleben mal hören wollen, schreibt es uns gerne in die Kommentare und wir fügen sowas immer mal wieder ein.
Grundsätzlich freuen wir uns natürlich wie immer über euer Feedback in den Kommentaren, auch in Form von Bewertungen und Co. Natürlich könnt ihr uns auch immer schreiben, wenn ihr Gastempfehlungen habt, Anregungen oder auch Themenwünsche. Bis dahin, alles Gute und die zweite Folge mit Michael Farmer folgt in Kürze.